This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and curator of the Tax Museum, Jeff Hoops. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
What's going on over in the Tax Museum today?
Not a whole lot. We've got some new artifacts come in a shipment this morning.
Oh, really? What came in today?
It's a long story, but some excellent new curated artifacts. As I say, ABC, always be curating. And that's what
so I is that is that really your motto? ABC, always be curating?
ABC, always be curating.
I, for some reason, I believe that. I mean, you are very aware of many different tax issues, which is quite impressive.
That's not only applies to the Tax Museum, also applies to Tax Chats. So just any interesting little item I see in the world, say, ah, that could be a Tax Chats episode, which is actually exactly how we got to where we are today.
Okay, so what are we doing today?
Okay, so before I say what specifically I want to talk about, I want to disclose something to Tax Chats listeners that I don't think we've ever actually made public. It's very important. The process behind tax.
There are certain secrets that should probably remain secret, Jeff.
No, this is not one of those. This is not going to be out in the open.
Okay.
I pretty much come up with all of the guests.
That is
and
true.
Do all of the invited.
That is true.
And it's basically in my day-to-day life, I see interesting things or things that are interesting to me, probably maybe not to other people, but interesting to me. And I email who I think might be able to talk about that thing. That's exactly what happened today. We'll get to that in a second. But one of my favorite things about my job is when I come up with something and I email the person, and then Scott and I are talking about this guest we're going to have on, and I'll say, we're going to talk about this topic, and Scott will literally not even have heard
of the topic.
That the topic exists. It's not that they don't know, that Scott doesn't know something about it or not, that he doesn't know much about it. It's that he literally hasn't even heard
that is
what the topic is.
Before. Well, that's because I'm not, my motto, my motto is not ABC. I'm not always curating. I'm losing my voice too, but yeah. So that is true. That does happen sometimes. And I'm ashamed to say that that is the case today. I had not heard of this topic, but Jeff had. So tell us what's happening, Jeff.
So we have with us today, Tracy Roberts, and we're going to be talking today about Cordell Hull, who Tracy contends is the father of the modern income tax system. So Tracy, can you introduce yourself a little bit, and then we'll talk about Cordell Hull.
Sure. My name is Tracy Roberts. I'm a professor of law at Cumberland Law School, Stanford University. And Cordell Hull just happens to be an alumnus of Cumberland School of Law. At the time, it was in Lebanon, Tennessee with Cumberland University. But in 1964, we acquired the law school for Stanford University.
Yeah, so I noticed Tracy has a law review article about Cordell Hull, and I thought this is going to be great. Let's talk about Cordell Hull. So I emailed her, and here we are talking about Cordell Hull. I did wonder, do you think you would have written the article without that connection to your university, or is Hull an interesting enough figure to write independent of your common affiliation?
He's definitely an interesting character. He is the father of the United Nations and won the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, in 1949 for that effort to build that body. Today I'm probably just going to talk about his work to build the modern income tax.
Yeah, so let's start there. So tell us a little bit about who Cordell Hull was, like where he came from, some highlights about his life, and then after that we'll get into his modern income tax creation.
He graduated from Cumberland School of Law in 1891. He worked as captain of the 4th Regiment of the Tennessee Volunteer Infantry during the Spanish-American War. He served as state representative in the Tennessee House of Representatives. He served for the 5th Judicial Circuit of Tennessee. He was a member of the United States House of Representatives for 23 years, and then he took office as a member of the U.S. Senate. Finally, he was a United States Secretary of State under FDR during World War II.
So the longest serving Secretary of State, actually, I believe that's the case. It's mostly just is because Roosevelt was the president for a long time. and they didn't want to change secretaries of state during World War
II. Well, hold on. Maybe it was because he was good at it, Jeff.
Could be. Could be. We won the war, and he was the secretary of state during World War II. So, okay, so he did a lot of things, like military, state politics, federal politics, House, federal politics, Senate, Secretary of State. And then you mentioned he basically like created the United Nations. It's still around, whether you like it or not. It's an enduring body. So a lot of stuff. But what does this have to do with the income tax system? So what does he have to do? I mean, my understanding is there's at least two like big things he had to do with the tax system. Let's start off with what he had to do with creating the modern income tax in 1913. So before Hull did what he did, where was the income tax system at previous to 1913?
But before 1913, and actually since the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, we had always relied primarily for federal revenues on tariffs and excise taxes. And so my article talks about his growing up in Western Tennessee in the Cumberland Plateau, and how those taxes, both at the state and the federal level, ended up impacting his family, who were, you know, basic farmers and very industrious, despite some grave injuries they had suffered during the Civil War. But Hull, at each step of his process through the political system, sought to try to aid his community and aid other people who were up-and-comers just like him. And so when you looked at the impact of the taxes and tariffs on both the American South and the population at large, the working class population was bearing the brunt of those taxes and tariffs. Meanwhile, the industrialists in the Northeast and any owner of stocks or other kinds of securities would escape taxation altogether. And so one of the primary goals that he had was to reduce the tariffs so that goods would be more affordable and the U.S. industrialists would have less of a monopoly because they would be subject to foreign competition, and to reduce the excise taxes as well. And the only way that you were able to do so during that period was by instituting an income tax. The income tax ended up being very important to us during World War I and World War II, because during times of war, you've got naval blockades and a reduction in shipping and a shift to wartime production, which means that a lot of the goods that you might have imported or might have been in demand are no longer imported or in demand because there's been a blockade. You've got a shift of demand for goods. And so as a result, without an income tax, I don't think that the outcome of World War II or World War I would have been the same. And so he happened to have instituted or worked and to institute that tax. And within a couple of years, we were facing a global international war. And so without those revenues, I don't think that we would be where we are today.
So his motivation was mostly he didn't like excise taxes, didn't like tariffs. He thought that the rich people in the North were better off with excises and tariffs, would be worse off with an income tax. We want an income tax. And so what exactly did he do?
Hang on, let's back up just a little bit, Jeff. That's kind of interesting to think about, because that assumes somebody like a pretty sophisticated thinking about the incidence of the tax and also about progressive versus regressive. And so when you think about taxes on goods, sometimes like maybe the more common forms now would be like a sales tax or a value-added tax. One of the big complaints is that they're regressive because as a fraction of your income, it's a higher fraction for a poor person, but a lower fraction for a rich person who doesn't spend all of their income. And so it sounds like he was thinking about a lot of fairly complicated tax items. I mean, is that fair to say, Tracy?
Yes, he had followed the income tax from the time of his youth. After graduating from law school, he worked as an attorney, but he was quickly involved in politics. I think the local population thought him to be one of the best educated and most far-seeing of the people in the community. And so very quickly, he was involved in, he was asked to be part of the Democratic Committee in Clay County. And then ultimately, he had an opportunity to drive Benton McMillan, his U.S. Representative, around the hills and hollers of Cumberland, the Cumberland Plateau, as he was campaigning, and learned a lot about the income tax from him, because Benton McMillan had been the person to propose and push through the 1894 initial modern income tax.
Can I just ask one more follow-up question just to get us a little bit of the background? So, so I'm not a native of North Carolina or the South. I grew up in Utah. But I have lived here for
to the extent that I grew up
exactly, and but I have lived here for 20 years, and I have been to, you know, Western North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee. You said he was from Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee. He's from so Eastern Tennessee. I mean, that would be kind of like Appalachia and very poor. This would have been, I guess, later, where during Prohibition we had a lot of the illegal alcohol trades and that kind of stuff going on. Is that all that going on in the same area?
He was born in the 1870s, just after the Civil War. So there are a series of at the time, generating alcohol or making alcohol, distilling alcohol, was not prohibited, but there were federal excise taxes on the sale of alcohol, and Tennessee itself exacted a privilege tax. So Tennessee had, and it still has today, privileges taxes for the privilege of doing business. And those privilege taxes allow sales or enterprises to exceed the limitations on sales tax, on the sale of those goods. So the privilege taxes are passed through to the consumers. And so as a result, you've got all of these local as well as federal taxes that impact the local population. One of the impacts was on his family itself. His family was not unique or uniquely poor, but his parents, one of the ways that they were able to get ahead and educate their children is by avoiding taxes. His mother, so there were significant excise taxes and tariffs on manufactured fabric. So his mother made homespun from scratch. There was, you took the flax and you carded it, and then you spun it into thread, and then you put the thread on the loom and you wove it into fabric, and that's what he wore for most of his childhood. He reports having gone to school, and he and his brothers having been subject to mockery as a result of wearing his homespun, because it marked a poor child. However, his parents were very thrifty, and so his mother, that the only way you could really get fabric to where they lived is by bringing it up the Cumberland River, and the fact that there were privilege taxes and excise taxes and tariffs on manufactured fabric, and on top of that, anyone who was a settler of a peddler of a sewing machine or took the ferry up the river had to pay additional taxes on that. It started to make sense that you would make your own fabric, even for his mother, who suffered terribly from rheumatoid arthritis. Father, likewise, was able to avoid taxes by having a still that he hid away in Buncombe Cave in the place where they lived in the Cumberland Plateau. And so I was able, when I went up and did the research at Cordell Hull State Park in Tennessee, I was able to visit the cave and see where they put the still. So if the reason that you would hide in the cave is to make the still scent and the still visibility less prominent to both federal and state revenuers.
Very interesting.
The revenuers. That's one of my favorite. The revenuers.
We need an entire episode on the revenuers. That'd be amazing. Yeah.
I have some tips for Jeff about things he might want to bring in his collection. with respect to the revenueers if he doesn't already have that in the collection at North Carolina?
Well, I think we should hear at least one of those tips maybe right now. Do you could tell us what one is?
Yes, you may have these in your collection. I hope that you do. When people were running alcohol, when they were trying to distill alcohol and sell it during Prohibition, there were these special foot coverings that they would put on their feet that were basically these pegs that were shaped like pigs. And so they would try to create pigs tracks to hide the fact that they were coming in and out of the area.
Really?
Yeah. Heard about this. Yes.
Do you have one, Jeff?
I do not have one. No.
I think it's a worthy.
That is worthy of the, that would be one of the prized possessions of the tax museum. We got to get one of those.
Looked, but not
not succeeded yet.
Looked, huh? But not succeeded.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's a very clever idea. Okay, we'll get some more tips from you after Tracy, but that's a good one for the tax museum. Sure. I like that.
And if you another thing is that if you decide to go to England, you need to go to Jamaica Inn. It was popularized by Daphne du Maurier. But if you go to the inn today, they also have the Smugglers Museum. And so there are beautiful artifacts there for you to take.
A rival museum.
Oh, wow. Yeah. A rival museum. Very good. All right. So, Jeff, I interrupted you a little while back, but I think we were trying to get into what exactly had to happen to, yeah.
What exactly happened on it? So we got all this like anti-Northern animus. We want to pass the income tax. What exactly role did he have in 1913? And actually, I just wanted to add something onto Scott. So Scott said he must have thought about this in sophisticated ways about incidents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't necessarily think that's true. Just because he thinks that like all the poor Tennesseans were worse off and the rich Northerners were better off under excise and tariffs instead of income taxes doesn't necessarily mean that's true. That was just his perception of reality.
If you're not taxing gains on the sales of stock, property's not subject to tax at the federal level. If you've got entire, you know, industrialists who are not having to pay any tax on the increase in value of their capitalist enterprise, then they're not paying any federal tax at all, and the burden is being disproportionately borne by the.
So I'm not saying what he's thought was not true. I'm just saying it doesn't need to be true. Scott
okay.
Assumed it was true.
Jeff with his technical argument.
A more general thing is just because a politician has some like desire to do something because they're motivated to do it because it's something they think in their head doesn't necessarily think it's true.
Yeah.
In this case, it might be, but true. Might not be.
But I mean, it does seem like it's something you would observe. Like if I'm hanging out with these relatively poor people in Appalachia, and I can see that everything they produce is taxed and everything they consume is a good that's taxed.
And you're scared of the revenueers.
And you're scared of the revenueers.
From the federal government.
Exactly.
And you don't like the federal government and you believe in states' rights, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera,
you
et cetera.
Can, it doesn't take somebody that, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to see that the people who are producing or earning a living from something other than producing like basic goods and services would be spending a lower fraction of their income in taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's get to that. So how does the 1913, I mean, what is the 1913 Act and how does Cordell Hull make it happen?
All right, so in 1894, after the original federal income tax had been passed, there had been prior federal income taxes during Civil War, and those had been tested through the legal system and had passed muster. But in 1894, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the federal income tax because they said that it was a direct tax. So, as you know, direct taxes are taxes set forth in the Constitution that must be apportioned among the states according to population. And so they concluded that rents associated with real property were direct taxes. I don't know if we would agree with that today, but at the time, that's what they concluded. And as a result, the whole income tax was scrapped. As a result, they needed a constitutional amendment, the 16th Amendment to be passed in order to authorize taxation of income. And so after there was, you know, significant efforts. And I've actually got another paper that covers the wheeling and dealing and the bargains, et cetera, associated with the ratification of the federal income tax that I'm hoping to get out later this year. But that had, once that was ratified, once the 16th Amendment was ratified, then at that point he had the tax, the income tax lined up and ready to be passed. And Woodrow Wilson came behind it to support it in Congress.
That was the corporate income tax or individual income tax?
The corporate income tax had been passed as an excise on incomes in 1909. And so as an excise tax, it passed muster. So the federal income tax was passed in 1913, shortly after the ratification of the 16th Amendment.
On an individual. And so was Cordell Hull like the main sponsor of the bill?
He's the drafter. He's the person.
The drafter.
Yeah.
Okay. And it flies through both House and Senate with no problems, or what, how did that process work?
There had been some challenges. I think that, I think that the Speaker of the House during the process of trying to, move forward with passing income tax, that would fall within the ambit that had been allowed under the prior, under the Civil War and under the ambit that had been set by the Supreme Court in 1894, they did some maneuvering. And so they said, well, what we need is a constitutional amendment. And so they thought that the amendment would be too difficult to pass and push through. But actually, that was very successful. And so as a result, a lot of the politicking that had forestalled the passage of an income tax ended up being bound up into the ratification of the 16th Amendment. And so by the time the income tax was ratified the 16th Amendment was ratified, the passage of the income tax was fairly straightforward.
So when you hear that Cordell Hull was the drafter of the original income tax,
yep,
does that make you think of him as a hero or as like the opposite of a hero? Does it make you happy to hear about Cordell Hull? Because I can imagine there's going to be people out there who are like, oh, I wish that guy would have never existed and we had no income tax. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, do I wish that? It all depends. I have no idea what I think, actually. I
guess
I'm relatively indifferent. So I do think that opening up an income tax allows for a larger scope of government. I was about to say, do I wish that like all the excise tax and tariffs were way bigger to support the spending that we have? I don't think we would spend as much had we not had an income tax. Yeah. So it to me basically is a question of like, what do you think about the size of government?
So it also, well, I think it's that, but I think it's more. It also depends on what you think about progressivity and redistribution through the income tax system, because that's much easier to do, I think, through an income tax than it is through like excise taxes. So some people would love that objective of the tax system. Some people would really dislike that. It's kind of interesting to think about, but yeah, I'm just curious what you thought.
Okay, so 1913, we have this tax now. My recollection is that the rate was relatively low and it applied to very few people.
That's correct. So in today's dollars, the personal exemption was about $70,000. So it was there was an enormous exemption. It only applied to the rather fairly high income households. Or high income individuals, because I don't think that we didn't have married filing jointly at that time. In addition, the rates were very low. They ranged. There was an income tax, and then there were surtaxes on top of it. And so the total, when you add those two together, ranged from 1% to 7%. So it was very low, and it only applied to the very high-income individuals.
Yeah, and I do think one kind of lesson from this, and it's very related, actually, to the question Scott just asked. You can imagine in Congress, they're saying, oh, let's pass an income tax. It's only going to apply to super rich people, and it's only going to be at most 7%. Like, don't worry, you won't have to pay it, and it's just this very low rate. But of course, as often happens, like, you know, the scope of who gets taxed grows, the rate grows, And as we saw in this,
well, and case. I think that exact argument is currently being used right now when we talk about a wealth tax. Oh, don't worry, you have to have 100 million of income to, and it's like, well, how long will that be the case? So,
and it was applied. It's applied many places. Yeah. Okay. So not only I think I started out saying he helped pass 1913 tax. We have an income tax. But I think he was pretty also instrumental in reforming the tax code in the 20s.
All right. So he drafted and supported. He repeatedly was introducing the income tax throughout until it was actually passed in 1913. In the 1920s, actually, the decrease in the income tax that followed World War II or World War I, it was the result of Andrew Mellon's pushing for taxes to be reduced. But he didn't do that until after World War I had been completely paid for. In terms of Cordell's efforts, it was in the during World War One that he was instrumental in increasing modifying the income tax so that it was able to cover the cost of U.S. involvement in World War One.
Okay, and so did he do that by increasing the rate, expanding the base? What changes did he push for during World War One?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different changes. There are several different taxes, other taxes that were imposed, but the main changes to the income tax were to reduce the exemption and to increase the rates. So I guess probably by 1917, the top rate on top incomes was, I think, 77%, including all of the all the surtaxes on above the standard sets of rates. But then those rates were applied to incomes in excess of, I would say, $55 million in today's dollars. So the income tax was very, I would say, it went deep into the income strata.
Did he end up paying income taxes, Cordell Hull?
I think he did. I'm pretty sure that he paid income taxes. Though I don't have access to his tax returns. I think it might have access to something like that in DC, but it wasn't available at the Cordell Hull birthplace. They didn't have those kinds of records.
No, I don't know how much you know about this episode, but there was a few years, it was like 1919, 20, and 21 or something like that, where the tax payments were publicly available for everybody. Do you know if he shows up in those records? And I have actually a folder on my computer with hundreds of PDFs of New York Times, versions of the New York Times with like all these.
And if you can pull it up, that would be great. I don't imagine that his holdings or his income would likely be high enough if they were, to the extent that you have information about all U.S. senators and members of the U.S. House of Representatives, he would be there. However, in terms of, you know, the high income earners that would be interesting to the New York Times, I'm not sure he would be among them.
Yeah, look, but my guess is not. So what else? Are we missing anything about Cordell Hull's tax accomplishments?
I guess the one thing that I do want to underscore is that after the Civil War, when tariffs remained in place, even though many of the Civil War taxes had been brought down, the tariffs remained in place and so did the excise taxes. And so I think the one thing that I would want to underscore is that those high tariffs protected U.S. manufacturers from competition. And so the concern there is that they were able to extract economic rents from the consumers as a result because they were protected from foreign competition. And they were able to raise the costs or raise the prices to the consumers. In addition, one of the things that happened during, so if you read the history of what had occurred, these tariffs and excise taxes remained very high, but of course there was no income tax. And there was also the issue of the Civil War, during the Civil War, having to the extent that there had been loans taken out. Following the Coinage Act of 1873, which demonetized silver, that means we went on the gold standard. And so you had taken out loans that ended up being much more expensive to pay back. So that with having any federal budget surpluses, finance policies, those policies did not benefit the South. Or even most of the West. They funded military pensions and disability payments for Union soldiers only. The tariff rent revenues funded Western expansion onto American Indian lands. And the South itself rejected efforts to try to improve education and build and expand railroads in the South. And so the South basically shot itself in the foot with regard to that. But certainly all of the revenues that were being collected did not end up being spent so much in the South. And so that continued to have an impact on Southerners and Westerners. So I think that important point to make. Not only was the Northeast, the industrialists in the Northeast, not paying taxes on any of the economic gains that they were enjoying, but they were also enjoying the majority of the revenues associated with the excise tariffs.
Best of both systems, those clever devils.
yeah, very, very fascinating. So I think it might, just maybe as we wrap up, can you briefly touch then on his post-tax career? So it sounds like he was Secretary of State and did some other things.
Yeah, he was the Secretary of State during World War II, or during the Great Depression and World War II. And following World War II, he anticipated a post-World War II recovery. And so it was with those during that period that he sought to establish the United Nations. If you look back at the Bretton Woods Accord and the things that they were trying to achieve, they wanted to reduce trade barriers so that more countries could enjoy prosperity and you'd be less inclined or less, we'd be less likely to see the kinds of results that we saw in Germany following World War I, when they were forced to pay reparations, but tariffs among other things, kept them from selling their manufactured goods to the United States and other countries. He felt like trade was the pathway to normalizing relationships between countries. And so a lot of the institutions that came out of Bretton Woods end up being in alignment with what he was trying to achieve with the United Nations.
That's really, really interesting. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing with us this interesting episode about this very fascinating person in history that, shamefully, I did not know very much about at all.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Well, I'm Scott Dyring, and as always, here with my co-host at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Jeff Hoops. Our guest today has been Tracy Roberts, who is professor of law at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University. We'll chat with you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.